Warning, this episode contains sexually explicit descriptions. It is not suitable for young children. Listener discretion is advised.
When I was 11 years old, my parents had already divorced and my mum was suffering quite severe mental health problems, so much so that she couldn't look after me anymore and I was living with my grandparents. My mum's a schizophrenic and my father came to visit and he took me out for the day and he told me that he had a woman's brain and a man's body and that he was going to be transitioning into a woman. And that was obviously a big shock. And it might have been the next day or a few days later. My grandfather wasn't there, but my grandmother was there. And my father dressed up as a woman and sort of came and sat with us and sort of introduced his new persona, you know, which had a different name, you know, lots of makeup and kind of big blouses to cover up the Adam's apple and things like that. And not long after that, I actually went to live with my father. He wanted custody and I lived with him throughout his transition until I was 18.
Try, if you can, to put yourself into this scenario. You're 11 years old, sitting with your grandmother, seeing your father wearing makeup and women's clothing for the first time ever. It's weird, right? And yet, as a society, we're telling children who are going through this that it's perfectly normal. Not just that it's normal, but that it's wonderful and something to be celebrated. If you're 11 years old and feeling uncomfortable about the whole thing, you might start wondering if there's something wrong with you. Children are often just an afterthought for men who pursue medical transition.
I think for a child of a transition, I think it's really, really difficult because your dad has fallen in love with himself and there isn't space for you in that love affair. You know, it's like he's gone off and he's had an affair with someone else, but that's him. It took me a really long time to understand that my feelings weren't important, that I wasn't important, you know, and you're a child and you think, well, you're supposed to love me and look after me. And he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't care.
Welcome back to Desexing Society. I'm your host, Stacia Fry. Episode 9, Children of Transitioners. Emma Thomas is now in her mid-50s, and it's taken her a long time to come to terms with her childhood and the impact of her father's transition.
I really buried a lot of my feelings about what happened between 11 and 18, and it would have stayed buried, and I wouldn't have been talking to anybody about it, really, except to explain why I come across as traumatised sometimes, except that this transgender issue exploded. And I became interested in it and I thought, can I contribute something to this discussion that uses my experience? So it's been a bit difficult because I've had to go back into what happened to me between 11 and 18 to talk about that. And I think I have some insights to share.
In 2019, Emma started the website childrenoftransitioners.org.
I started writing really as a kind of a misery memoir of how awful it was and how awful my dad was and how awful it was to my mother and how she had a schizophrenic breakdown as a result of his awful behaviour and all these things. In the course of writing about that, people have got in touch with me and I've started talking to people who've had similar experiences. And what I thought was an individual experience with an individual who had, you know, very specific things. So there was alcoholism, there was narcissistic abuse, there was emotional blackmail, there was gaslighting, there was all that kind of thing. What started to shock me was all of these people coming to me with exactly the same story, pretty much. You know, that their father's behaviour was really similar. His behaviour towards their mothers, the behaviour towards them, that there were lots and lots of things that were similar, you know, emotional abuse, financial abuse, all of those things. So I thought, hang on a minute, there's a pattern here. And recognising the pattern is something that we do, trans widows do. But of course, I don't think clinicians do.
We learned the meaning behind the term trans widows in the last episode. These are women whose male partners have transitioned, leaving them feeling as though the man they married has died. Children of transitioners have a similar experience of loss.
When you're a child, you love your dad. I loved my dad so much. You know, he was everything to me. He was funny. He was lovely. And then at some point he said, you know that bit where I was your dad? All of that time was fake. All of that time, it wasn't the real me. And I was miserable. And when we talk about mourning, you know, like grief, I feel like my dad died when I was about 11, but there was this other person around. So I wasn't able to recognize that as grief. Imagine the sort of the psychological impact of your father saying all that time, I was really miserable.
Long before her father's announcement, Emma had sensed that something was off with her family.
And I was really aware that there was something wrong with my family, but I didn't know what. Like, so I think everybody knew that my dad was cross-dressing, because I think sometimes he walked around our little village cross-dressed, and he went to the local pub in women's clothes sometimes. But of course, I didn't know. So I had this very weird experience where everyone is behaving really strangely. And my mother was really odd because she was having a schizophrenic breakdown. So everyone was behaving really oddly towards me and my family, but I didn't know why. Like, our next door neighbour was in the kitchen one day. She had an awful accident. She nearly cut off her finger. It was like a huge gash in her hand. And she came out of our house, and I remember afterwards seeing the trail of blood. She came out of her house and she walked all the way around our house, even though we were in, to get help from another house. Because she didn't want to come to us because we were so weird. And there was a little boy next door and we were like best friends. We used to play together all the time. And then one day his parents said, we're moving. And later I discovered that they'd actually just moved to like a few roads away to an identical house, not very far away. So clearly people were moving away to not be next to my family. So I think it adds to this very odd paranoia where you were just convinced there's something wrong with you. And there was, you know, my family were really weird.
There was also a strange rule imposed on Saturdays that didn't make much sense. Another clue that something odd was going on around her.
So when I was a kid, every Saturday morning, I wasn't allowed to come out of my bedroom for a couple of hours. So I'd wake up and I'd be quite excited because it was Saturday morning, it was no school. But for a couple of hours, I was not allowed to come out of the room. And then I would come out of the room and there'd be lots of treats and we'd go to the shop and we'd watch Fantastic Four and things like that. It was all great. But I don't know, maybe until 9 or 10 o'clock. I can't remember exactly. But it turns out that was when he was cross-dressing.
Her parents' relationship was unstable and that led to Emma and her mother's housing situation also being unstable.
I do remember him hitting her. I wasn't supposed to see that. I was just kind of, I could hear shouting and I went to look and he whacked her across the face. So I don't know. I think it might have just been, it got too much. So we went to live with her sister for a while. Her sister wasn't really happy to have us. Mum got a job in a department store and she tried really hard. But when you're having a schizophrenic breakdown and you're trying to look after a child, it wasn't working. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what started it, but I think they were in crisis and it couldn't go on anymore. Yeah. And we were homeless for a bit, you know, like every time we had a row with her sister, you know, my mum had a row with her sister, she'd get chucked out and we'd be like walking the streets trying to find somewhere to stay. You know, she had so little money. I mean, it was impossible, really. So fortunately, my father's parents, my grandparents, stepped in and took me.
She lived with her grandparents for about 2 years before her father's big announcement. And then she went to live with him full time.
I literally just arrived and I just you know, I was in the kitchen and something, I think the tap wasn't working, something happened, and I went, "Dad," and I called across, and he just came in and he was like, "What did you say?" You know, like really angry. My dad didn't hit me, you know, there wasn't anything like that, but there was like, he was absolutely mad. And I think that was, I was scared out of my wits, because I'd literally never seen him that angry with me before. My dad had always been the calm, friendly, you know, kind of thing. And that was the beginning, really, I think, of just a very emotionally abusive experience. My teens were just full of a great deal of emotional abuse.
After a difficult childhood, Emma's teenage years were just as challenging, if not more so. At the same time that she was going through puberty, her father's body was also changing.
It was, yeah, really strange. The hormones, you know, how it taking the hormones and his appearance changing and things like that. Yeah, and I think it's very unusual to be living with your dad while that process happens.
Because of the sexual nature of autogynephilia, growing up with her father meant that Emma was exposed to adult sexuality at a young age.
My dad went to gay pubs all the time. He was an alcoholic, so he had to go to the pubs. And so I spent a lot of time just sitting in gay pubs throughout my teens. You know, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but there's a little bit of grooming because you're, you know, like all the people in the gay pubs were like, "Oh, it's so great that you get to be here and everyone's so understanding." And I think I see some of that now where people are so like, "Oh, all the kids are learning about being LGBT and how great that was," and that kind of stuff. And I'm like, they're all things that I probably shouldn't have seen, you know, shouldn't have experienced that young, really. We watched films, all those kind of gender bending films. There was a lot of that kind of like, you know, that you've got to be more grown up. You're growing up. You're special. You can cope with these grown up films. You can cope with this grown up material, that kind of thing, which I think people who've suffered sexual abuse, which I didn't, will be familiar with that thing about, look how mature you are for your years. There was that because I was so understanding and I could cope with all this grown-up material. You know, there was kind of sissy porn around. My dad was like, "That's not me, that's just the newsletters I get." But there was a lot of that sort of stuff around.
It's a well-known tactic of pedophiles to first build trust and an emotional connection with a child. One way to do this is to praise the child by telling them they're mature for their age. After building trust, the next step in the grooming process is testing boundaries. An example of this could be showing the child pornography to gauge their reaction and to normalize sexual acts. I find it quite disturbing that Emma sees parallels between what happened to her and what happens to victims of child sexual abuse. Another troubling similarity is the condition of secrecy. Pedophile groomers will tell the child that the abuse is their little secret. But this can also take the form of a threat. For example, "If you tell anyone, you'll get in trouble." Sadly, young Emma was also threatened into staying silent about risky things that were happening in her home.
He moved this kind of transvestite prostitute into our house. We live in this tiny little flat. And he moved him in for like several months. And then he said, "If you ever say anything, I will stop loving you. I won't love you anymore." So there was lots of that, you know, where it was the emotional blackmail of, "I will withdraw speaking to you. I will withdraw everything if you don't completely cooperate all the time." So I was in absolute misery. I was just so traumatized.
In response to the emotional trauma, Emma comforted herself with food.
So I had such an extreme eating disorder. I was much bigger than I am now. It's very, very big. You know, the classic fat as a feminist issue thing about, this is my armor. I am protecting myself. You know, this is what I'm doing. And he sat me down and he said, "You know, no man will ever want to fuck you." You know, that was his big parental advice. "You're so fat, no man will ever want to have sex with you, Emma. Because your purpose," to my father, "the purpose of a woman is to be fucked." that my only value was in a sexual context.
This very male idea of what a woman is once again betrays the fact that trans women are men. For young Emma, this wasn't the only sexist, misogynistic messaging that she received whilst living with her father. Before the internet, one of the ways that transvestites and transsexuals connected with each other was through newsletters. Emma's father subscribed to such newsletters and was happy to accommodate his friends when they visited England.
Because my dad had lots of transsexuals visiting, or transsexuals would come from the States, and they'd come and visit and stay. And when I look back now with adult eyes, what I really see is interesting is they all had awful attitudes towards their exes. They had no empathy with women at all. They didn't particularly like women. Now, you talk to an average guy, you know, I go out and I've got lovely neighbours and friends and things like that, and you talk to an average guy, he's got quite a lot of understanding about what it's like to be a woman in terms of, you know, they're married, their wives have had children. There's a kind of normal, you know, understanding. But the transsexuals didn't have that. They just didn't understand. So in this kind of desire to appropriate, walk within the skin of, in a sense, women had to be othered. You know, it was kind of actual women had to be kind of go in the corner over there so that they could wear the clothes and do the whole thing.
Years later, in the course of writing her blog, Emma reached out to her father's second wife, who recounted yet another example of his lack of empathy for women.
My dad had two exes because he married again after my mother, and it was awful. He took all her money and she had an awful experience. And so one thing that happened was she became pregnant and she miscarried twins. And she nearly died in the process because she bled so much. I mean, it was, you couldn't just imagine. So she's lying in a hospital bed and she's just lost these babies and nearly lost her life. My father comes in, it's the only time he visits her in hospital. He's not there at all. And he comes in and he says, "You have fulfilled your role as a woman and now I will fulfill mine." And he walks out. And so years later, I have this conversation with her. You know, we get in touch. I'm like, so, you know, I'm writing this blog and I'm interested in what's happened to you. And she tells me this story. And I'm just like, as a woman, and I've not had children, I hear that story and I have a visceral reaction to it. I feel like I'm her. You can feel it, can't you? Somehow in your whole body, how awful that experience must have been. But my father wouldn't even visit her. I don't know a man who wouldn't have been there holding her hand, apart from my dad, who thinks he's a woman.
After his second marriage failed, he took custody of Emma and committed full-time to his medical transition.
But we lived in a very small flat, you know. And yeah, it was invasive, I suppose. I think it was very uncomfortable because my father was developing breasts and, you know, then he had his operation. That was quite distressing. A couple of things went wrong. His urethra healed up a few times, so he had to go into hospital and it looked possible that it would keep healing over, in which case he would have been quite disabled. But they seemed to have been able to open it up surgically. I remember once there were two district nurses who came in just to check to see that his operation had gone okay. And one of them came out and she stood in the living room and she looked at me and she said, "It's too weird. I can't go in." I think it had been too strange, you know, this kind of faux vagina. I did see it. He kept on kind of sitting with his legs open. And at one point I said, "Could you wear some pants, please?" And he did. He put on some knickers, but that was a bit, what was that about? Why did I have to see it? I don't know.
I also wonder what this was about. Did he think that this was something that female family members normally do around each other? Or was it perhaps his way of proving to his daughter that he was just like her now? Whatever the reason, it was clearly inappropriate. and just another example of how trans women are not really women.
I went on Twitter in 2017, and at some point I saw this thing about autogynephilia, and I started to look more. I looked into what Blanchard had written and Michael Bailey. That was quite interesting. I read Galileo's Middle Finger and things like that. And that was, yeah, an absolute revelation.
You might remember those names from season one of Desexing Society. If not, here's a quick recap. Dr. Ray Blanchard is the psychologist and researcher who coined the term autogynephilia in the 1980s. Dr. Michael Bailey, also a psychologist, picked up where Blanchard left off and continued the research into autogynephilia. In 2003, he published his book, The Man Who Would Be Queen, The Science of Gender Bending and Transsexualism. Following the book launch, Bailey was ruthlessly harassed, both personally and professionally, by transsexuals who wanted him destroyed for having written about autogynephilia. Dr. Alice Drager, an advocate for people who have intersex conditions, wrote about Bailey's ordeal in her book, Galileo's Middle Finger. It's not surprising that Emma describes learning about autogynephilia as a revelation. After all, for 35 years, the truth of her father's condition had been hidden from her.
My father had implied that there was something wrong with the way that he was born. You know, that he said he had a female brain and a male body. And I had been a child when he told me that, and I just accepted that, right? And so, you know, you have the narrative and you go through your whole life and you think, well, that's my dad who has the female brain and the male body. And then, of course, you start listening to feminists in 2017 and they go, what does that mean? Because I hadn't asked that question. What does that mean? And I thought, hang on a minute, because I have a female brain and a female body and I don't want to wear makeup. I don't care about those things. I don't care at all. In fact, I mean, I'm just hopeless. I think I'm pathologically bad at dressing. As a woman, I'm just bad at doing any of those things. I've never been able to work makeup out, all that kind of stuff. So I was kind of like, well, what does that mean? Right? And then I thought, hang on a minute. And this was, honestly, a feminist awakening in me where I was just kind of like, that's rubbish. That's so stupid. And so I realised I found out about this condition. I thought, oh my God, this is not just my dad, but these are all my dad's friends. These are all these transsexuals who turned up. And they were all like this. And it explains how obsessed they were with how they look, how they talked about women, how they were. And honestly, the clothes, they're all obsessed with the clothes. You know, like they're shopping for clothes and wearing the clothes and all the underwear, all that sort of stuff. And when I read about autogynephilia, I got it because I've seen my father kind of blowing kisses to himself in the mirror, putting on makeup and lipstick and. And I get that actually he's fallen in love with the person in the mirror. And there's no room for anyone else in that love affair. You know, and it's very, and this narcissism, it is just all about him.
There seems to be significant overlap between autogynephilia and narcissistic personality disorder. Certainly, if you listen to trans widows and children of transitioners, they'll confirm this. Unfortunately, there's been very little research into the overlap between the two conditions. I found a 2014 journal paper from Iran titled The Frequency of Personality Disorders in Patients with Gender Identity Disorder. Of the 73 participants in the study, an alarming 81.4% had a personality disorder, and the most common type was narcissistic personality disorder, which affected 57.1% of the patients. This is far higher than the general population, where only 6.2% have the disorder. Unfortunately, this doesn't tell us much about narcissism and autogynephilia, because the sample was a mix of both males and females pursuing sex reassignment surgery. The researchers also didn't differentiate between the two types found in men: homosexual transsexualism and autogynephilic transsexualism. As valuable as Blanchard and Bailey's work was for Emma's understanding of autogynephilia, she's convinced that they never saw the full picture.
if you look at, say, Michael Bailey and Ray Blanchard and things like that, that they really like these guys. These guys turn up to their clinics and they're charming. I tell you what, this is narcissistic personality disorder, people. They're really charming. My dad was really charming, could always kind of win people over. So you imagine those people, they go to these clinics and they turn on the charm and they're really amazing. And Michael Bailey loves them and Blanchard's like, I really like these people. But they don't know what's going on at home. They don't see anything about what gets turned on to people who don't cooperate. The anger that gets turned towards women and children if they fail to cooperate is really quite something to behold.
The anger that Emma is describing is known as narcissistic rage, and it can be terrifying. A prime example of this is trans-identified male Tiffany Moore, also known as GameStop Ma'am. In early 2019, a video of him verbally abusing a cashier at a video game store went viral on social media.
You're gonna give me my fucking money back.
Excuse me, sir, there's a young man in here.
Excuse me, it's ma'am. It is ma'am.
I can call the police if you'd like me to. You need to settle down.
You need to settle down and mind your business, okay? Ma'am, once again, ma'am.
I said both of you.
No, you said sir. Once again, it's ma'am.
I actually said both of you guys. It was a general.
Right beforehand, you fucking said sir.
Sir?
Motherfucker, take it outside. If you want to call me sir again, I will show you a fucking sir.
I apologize.
Motherfucker.
I apologize now.
The bang you heard at the end there is GameStop Ma'am kicking over a product display as he heads for the door. He looks and sounds just like a violent, angry man. And the thing that's triggered this violent outburst is the cashier referring to him as sir. You might think that being called sir is a common experience for a man who says he's a woman. After all, we humans can determine a person's sex within milliseconds of looking at them. So calling an obviously male person ma'am means we have to override what we're actually thinking. And that takes conscious effort. As we just heard, even when facing an irate, abusive customer on the verge of violence, the truth still slips out.
Right beforehand, you fucking said, sir!
Sir?
Motherfucker, take it outside! If you want to call me sir again, I will show you a fucking sir!
So why can't GameStop Ma'am put himself in the shoes of the cashier? Why can't he understand that other people see him as a man, and that means, even if they don't mean to, sometimes they're going to call him sir? This brings us back to the question, what is the relationship between autogynephilia and narcissistic personality disorder? People with narcissism come across as self-obsessed, full of themselves, and lacking in empathy for other people. But behind this outwardly self-centered persona hides a fragile and wounded self that has been crippled by a deep sense of shame. Psychologists believe that narcissism develops in early childhood. Through traumatic events or through unstable relationships with the mother and/or father, the child comes to believe that there's something inherently wrong with them at their core. They're damaged and unlovable. So the child creates a false, idealized self in order to avoid this unbearable sense of shame. Of course, this process is unconscious, so the narcissistic individual believes the idealized self is their true self. Psychotherapist Dr. Joseph Burgo believes that for many autogynephilic men, a similar process is at play. In his article, Are Trans Rights Activists Victims or Bullies? Burgo writes the following, quote, "For the troubled young men in my psychotherapy practice who have detransitioned, their female identity represented such an idealized false self. By imagining themselves to be female, my clients had taken flight from a shame-ridden self which was felt to be defective, damaged, and beyond repair. When this defensive new identity finally broke down, they found themselves engulfed in pain, confusion, and shame, and as a result sought professional help." End quote. When GameStop Ma'am was called Sir, it brought him back to the painful reality that he's not the false self that he's pretending to be. He's not a woman, and other people don't see him as a woman. The delusion was interrupted, and the offending cashier had to be destroyed. Now, imagine being an 11-year-old child, like Emma once was, on the receiving end of such overwhelming rage.
I know that lots of people have narcissistic parents and have that experience. It's just here, there's further gaslighting because your dad is then saying things like, I am now authentic. I'm now authentically me. The authentic him doesn't love you. That's really difficult. It's a difficult experience, you know, and it's very traumatic. And I don't know how you can go through that and not have some damage. I wrote a piece called Not Shutting Up, and what I did was I just went, and it was like 10 minutes Googling. It was really not a lot of time. And I found a whole pile of trans sex offenders. And I looked at the news reports and they all had children. Karen White has 2 kids.
We covered the infamous case of Karen White back in episode 5, Prisons. White was a serial sex offender with multiple prior convictions. The UK prison services placed him in a women's prison because he said he was a woman. For 3 months, he terrorised the female inmates and sexually assaulted at least 2 of them. Until Emma pointed it out, it honestly never occurred to me that he might have children.
You know, there's a whole pile of them, and they all have kids, all of these sex offenders, because they're all late stage, you know, transitioners, aren't they? They've all come out, sort of gynophiles, and then they're finding child sex images on their computers, or they've assaulted somebody, all of those kind of things. I think it's important for us to acknowledge that there is this link between autogynephilia, and so it's a paraphilia, so it clusters with other paraphilias. They're more likely to do and say sexual things because of this condition.
This brings us to a difficult question, but it has to be asked. Should autogynephiles be given custody of children?
Personally, no. And I would really like to see social workers at least be overseeing that. In my case, my mother couldn't look after me. And you see other ones where they've got custody, there's some problem, the woman's sick, and things like that. So they've got custody. But every time I look at that, it's dodgy as hell. And I don't know what goes on for those kids. But if you look at, for example, the It's Mom guy, you remember that guy?
Emma is referring to GameStop Ma'am.
Excuse me, it's Ma'am. It is Ma'am.
Right? He's got a son. And there are pictures of him with his child. He's naked, the child's semi-naked there. The child's wearing a dog collar at one point. And you just sort of think, okay, who's overseeing that? Could there be somebody kind of coming in and saying, how safe is that child?
I have to correct Emma here, although she's not too far off the mark. The pictures she's remembering were featured in a video by YouTuber and transsexual Blair White. The young boy is shirtless and lying in between his father's naked thighs. But GameStop Ma'am isn't entirely naked. We can see that he's wearing pink underwear. In another of his social media photos, he and his male partner are both wearing fetish dog collars in front of his son.
And I'm talking about the fact that there is a very sexual nature to what these men are doing. And that's a sexual nature that's escalating. And I don't know how someone like that can be looking after a child and that's healthy. It wasn't for me, although, you know, I wasn't sexually abused. But nevertheless, I am very aware of sexual abuse that happens in these scenarios. I'm aware of children who are exposed to much more sexual content and sexual danger. This isn't healthy.
As we learnt in the episode on prisons, more than half of the trans-identified males in UK prisons have been convicted of sexual crimes. Autogynephilia is a red flag. Unfortunately, the transgender industry has been very successful in normalizing autogynephilia. Police, schools, social services, courts, all these sectors that are supposed to recognize when a child is in danger have been groomed to believe that trans women are women. And of course, if they're really women, then they're not considered a safeguarding risk.
These guys are being seen as they're brave and they're doing a very stunning and amazing thing, and that the role of wives and children is to be supportive. You are just there to be supportive of them. And my big concerns are, how would you report abuse? If you're like, it's mom's child or some other child, how do you report what's going on at home? Who do you talk to? So you go into school, right? And I know this because I know of children who've had this experience where you go into school and you try and talk to somebody. And that somebody is gone through all the training and they're going to be saying, you can't refer to your father as your father. You can't talk about your dad. You can't use those pronouns. You can't be saying that you're a problem from the minute you start speaking. The minute you start saying there is a problem, they're not geared up for there to be a problem. And they're not going to want to hear it. What happens? You go to the police. What happens when you go to the police? You go in there, they have autogynephile officers, they've had all the training, they don't want to hear that there's a problem.
Emma's comments prompted me to look at what's happening with the police in my home state of Victoria. I quickly found their publicly available LGBTIQ+ Inclusion Action Plan for 2023 to 2024. Skimming through the 24-page document, I discovered that Victoria Police have been members of ACON's Pride and Diversity since 2015. That's 10 years of ideological grooming of police officers. In 2021, they achieved a silver ranking in ACON's Australian Workplace Equality Index. In 2020, more than 400 Victoria Police employees underwent LGBTIQ+ awareness sessions, presumably delivered by ACON. We don't know exactly what kind of training was in those sessions. Were police instructed that misgendering was a form of violence? Were they taught that unsupportive wives and children are simply transphobic? What we do know is that no police officer would have heard the term trans widow or autogynephilia in any of those training sessions. So then, what would Victoria Police do if they were called out to the following scenario?
This happened to someone who has been in touch with us, whose daughter, well, there's a group of girls, they're getting changed for a dance competition, dance recital, and the father, who has just recently transitioned, still looks incredibly male, walks in, and there are all these 12-year-old girls, and they're like, get out, and he's like, I've got the right to be here. And he's just standing there watching these girls. And eventually they're like, well, it's not going to happen. The tournament is going to happen. Like, we're not going to compete. We're not going to do anything because you're here. And eventually he gets persuaded to leave. But that's sort of what's going on. What's going on with that man that suddenly he thinks he's allowed to go in with all those girls?
This example really disturbs me. It demonstrates just how far an autogynephile can drift from consensus reality. It's not normal behaviour. In any other context aside from trans, it would be considered predatory behaviour. But would the police view it that way? And can you imagine being that man's daughter? You would feel completely grossed out and humiliated in front of your dance friends. But the trans industry simply can't acknowledge that children might have negative feelings around their parents' transition. Instead, children are encouraged to become cheerleaders for their queer fathers.
Because there's a book that this group Collage have written called My Trans Parent. There's a little industry there with some books. There's some books for children, which is about how you can be the right kind of child of a trans parent. And it was like, now you can go to Pride. That's the thing. You're now part of a queer family. So you're part of the queer community. And this is what you're part of. And I was just, I'm horrified by it. I really am. The behaviours are all about negating yourself. And I think particularly for girls, be submissive, don't speak out, be supportive. And if you've been there and met me at 15, I would have been fiercely in my father's corner, you know, because that's what you do when you're a girl. You protect all these people. And there's that sort of martyrdom that you kind of adopt. And that's the worst thing that girls can do. And it's the worst thing that we can say to girls is be submissive and just submerge yourself for these other people.
It must be so confusing for children. On the one hand, they're feeling embarrassed or uncomfortable because of their father's strange behaviour. But on the other hand, the whole of society is telling them they should be happy and celebrating. In her blog post titled "The Autogynephile in the Room," Emma wrote the following, quote, "When your father wants to go to a bra fitting or makeup session with you, or wants to know all about your period, that's autogynephilia too. If your father is doing this, he is involving you in his erotic world." End quote. This is the terrible truth for daughters of autogynephiles. And we're doing those girls no favours by ignoring the sexual nature of their father's transition. For sons of autogynephiles, the problems are different, but not insignificant.
I mean, I talk about from a female perspective. I am trying to get men to write for my site as well, because there's some really sad stories out there about boys who are kind of like, you're supposed to show me how to be a man. You're supposed to be there for my key moments. And they're talking to someone who's trying to run away from all of that.
Even for adult children of transitioners, the experience is still hard to process.
What's been interesting to me as well is I've had some contact from people who didn't have that when they were children, but, you know, they're adults, they're in their 20s or 30s or 40s even, and their fathers say, I'm transitioning. And it's still really difficult.
An example here is Caitlin, formerly Bruce Jenner. On the Alec Baldwin show, his stepdaughter, Kim Kardashian, described the disturbing moment she discovered Bruce cross-dressing.
I found out when I was maybe 25. I had walked in on Caitlin. My mom was out of town, and I walked in on Caitlin, all dressed up. It was Bruce, but dressed up as a woman in the garage at my mom's house. And I ran in, packed a bag so fast, shaking, and ran out and called Courtney and said, I have to come spend the weekend with you. And I was hysterically crying. And she just was like, what is it? Did you catch Bruce cheating? And I was like, I wish. I don't know what I just saw.
Clearly, Kim was deeply affected by what she'd witnessed. It was so upsetting that she was crying and shaking. Her body had gone into fight or flight mode. Nonetheless, 10 years after that incident, having kept his secret all that time, Kim would become one of Bruce's biggest cheerleaders. Within just weeks of him announcing that he was transitioning, she went on the USA Today show to sing his praises.
Bruce is the most honest. Just, he has the biggest heart, and I'm really happy for him that he is living his life the way he wants to live it, and that he has found inner peace and just pure happiness. That's what life is about.
I think Kim Kardashian is a prime example of how children, or stepchildren, learn very quickly to suppress their discomfort and play a supporting role in their father's paraphilia. I do wonder, though, with increasing awareness of autogynephilia, are the Kardashians now also aware of the condition? When Emma turned 18, she moved out of her father's flat and went to university. After that, he completely lost interest in her, Eventually, she came to recognize that he has narcissistic personality disorder. She learned a strategy known as grey rocking to deal with him. The idea is to not react when provoked and to not engage with any of the mind games. In short, you're deliberately being as boring as a grey rock so that the narcissist becomes disinterested in trying to manipulate you.
You know, I just grey rock my dad. We do share texts now and again when my dad sort of says how awful his mother was and boasts about how many holidays he goes on and how many coffee machines he owns, and he never once asks me how I am. Never once. Despite the fact that he knows that I went through stage 3 cancer, he never once asks me anything about it or how I am.
Knowing what she knows now, what advice would Emma give to other kids going through what she went through?
Find out how to deal with a narcissist. Just go online. TikTok's got loads of videos. YouTube's got lots of videos. And then lots of things that you can say and do that just take some of that aggression off you. And also talk about it. If your dad is doing something that makes you uncomfortable, that is you think is abusive, or you're any way uncomfortable with what's going on, find an adult, talk to that adult, because I was bullied into silence. I really was, and made to feel like I was my dad's champion and I couldn't possibly say anything. And one of the things that was happening was, it wasn't just if I complained about my dad, all transsexuals would suffer, right? That I was betraying all of these poor people if I complained about my father, that I was responsible not just for my father's emotions, but also all of these transsexuals, which I really took on board. I thought, oh my God, I can't say anything. It's just my dad who's an alcoholic, emotionally abusive, horrible person. All of these poor transsexuals are lovely. And obviously not, and you're not responsible for them. So speak. And I know obviously it's difficult because schools are captured and the police captured and things like that. Can you find an adult that you can talk to? And if so, then talk to them and just tell them what's going on.
After starting her blog, other children of transitioners have reached out to Emma. She's acted as counsellor as they share their stories with her. And she's opened her blog up for others to write about their experiences. It's also led to her speaking at the House of Lords.
I went to the House of Lords and I spoke about my experience alongside a trans widow, and people were really sympathetic. And I thought, oh my God, we're such a niche group of people. We're so small. We're never going to be a political force. You know, we're never going to unite and it's never going to work. We're just a bunch of traumatized people. But there are people out there who are listening to us and want to do something to help us. And I thought that was just amazing.
There's one thing that I find puzzling about Emma's story. Her father could have easily left her with his parents, freeing him up to do whatever he wanted. But instead, he wanted custody of Emma. The question is, why? If he was a narcissist, surely it wasn't out of concern for Emma's welfare. So what was it about?
Imagine you're walking down the street and there are lots of people walking past you. You're not looking at those people. You're kind of clocking them. You're looking for a threat. But if they just look like regular people, you're not going to spend a lot of time looking at them. Now, here was this person who was walking around with a child, with a young woman. You're not really going to look at them that hard. You're going to assume that they're a woman. So I noticed a lot of trans-identified men talk about, oh, I passed and nobody says anything. If you're sitting next to them in a restaurant and you've got a bit more time, then you'll clock the Adam's apple, the big hands, no hips, all that kind of thing. You'll clock it. But a lot of the time, you're not looking that hard. So if they sort of resemble women, you're going to let that go. And I was definitely very useful as a kind of a beard, really. You don't really look at a woman who's with, you know, a child.
In follow-up questions I sent to Emma, she wrote the following in reply. Quote, I think it's difficult when normal people look at autogynephiles to comprehend that it is not so much about being something. People have to see you being something. Even alone with a mirror, in their head, there are two people there, a gorgeous woman and a man looking upon her with desire. End quote. For her father, having custody of Emma was about being seen. She was there to witness and validate his woman identity. She was proof to others that his transition was successful, because here he was, lovingly caring for his daughter, who loved him in return. And importantly, he could play the role of mother, which was more validation of his woman gender identity. In short, just like the makeup and the dresses are props to achieve the autogynephilic fantasy, Emma, too, was, sadly, a prop. Coming up in the next episode of Desexing Society, we'll investigate the extraordinary influence the trans lobby has in local government.
They've had a main seat at the table on many of these issues, and through things like the Rainbow Accreditation and Rainbow Votes program, what they have really successfully done is infiltrated every council's thinking and influenced council officers.
We'll examine how councils are putting women's safety at risk.
Every single time I entered the women's change room, he was in there, fully clothed, in like a long skirt and a jacket. He would be standing near the wall, drying his already dry hair, watching the women and little girls all around him getting changed.
And we'll explore why councils keep inviting drag queens to read books to small children.
Drag queen story time, some of the stories that I've seen would really confuse children about the reality of their bodies and about sex.
Thanks for listening to Desexing Society, written and produced by me, Stacia Fry. Thank you to my script editor, Miss Edie Wyatt, my sound technician, Matthew Friend, and to Emma Thomas for appearing in this episode. For more information or to donate towards this project, which I paid for myself, please visit desexingsociety.com.